Today's podcast of The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
U.S. General Ken Keene's humanitarian invasion of Haiti ramps up, and the nation begins to step back from the brink.
We will increase our capacity both within the number of troops, but as importantly with logistical vehicles and enable us to get out to the much-needed areas.
Meanwhile, aboard the USNS Comfort hospital ship, Naval Surgeon Tim Donahue says his patients are resting comfortably.
Our youngest patient is now 72 hours old, and our oldest is 82.
Generals and hospitals in Haiti on The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee from Public Radio International and WNYC.
Good morning, everyone. On this Thursday, January 21st, I'm back in New York with Miles O'Brien in for Celeste Headlee. The Takeaway is this morning, I think, seeking that moment, that threshold where the relief operation actually begins to improve the situation in Haiti rather than sort of bottleneck.
Yeah, you have to wonder if it's an improvement or if we're just moving into another phase where there's less attention paid and it becomes more oppressive for the people there. Let's get right to the top stories we're following for you this morning.
Well, we can pick up with Haiti there. And yesterday I had the pleasure of speaking with the highest ranking military officer in the U.S. about the relief effort, Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, Admiral Michael Mullen. And I asked him how much the difficulties the Haitian government is having in the wake of the earthquake may have held back the arrival of medical facilities and supplies in a time of really critical moment-to-moment need.
I'm not aware the impact, the difficulties the Haitian government has had in standing up. I mean, it was in great part decapitated by this. They lost a lot of senior people. They also lost a lot of ministries. So it's in its own way trying to stand back up as well. So I haven't seen them impeding progress here. We certainly are in touch with them about what's going on. And again, there's a big international medical effort right now. And literally as we speak, a little more than a week after the earthquake, while we still have a long way to go with food, a long way to go with water, a great emphasis right now is being placed on getting the medical help out there. There are clear challenges, significant challenges that remain on the medical side that we're really trying to break through.
Chairman of the Joint Chiefs talks to The Takeaway. We'll have more from my interview with Admiral Mike Mullen in just a moment.
Aside from the aid the Admiral spoke of, the Pentagon is ordering another 2,000 Marines to Haiti. Lieutenant General Ken Keene, the commander of the U.S. military effort in Haiti, describes the mission this way.
We're building this airplane while it flies.
The disaster zone that is Port-au-Prince, the scene remains desperate, with limited supplies and doctors. This aid worker says some of the deaths she's seeing at a makeshift hospital are hard to take.
Harder when they come in conscious and begging you to save them. And there's nothing we can do.
Wow. President Obama and the First Lady are joining Americans in making donations to help the victims in Haiti. They're donating $15,000 from their personal bank account to the Clinton-Bush Haiti Fund.
Big story here in the United States. The president is blaming the Democrats' stunning loss of their filibuster-proof Senate majority on his failure to connect to economic frustrations of the middle class. He told ABC News last night.
The Senate certainly shouldn't try to jam anything through until Scott Brown is seated. People in Massachusetts spoke. He's got to be part of that process.
The process of health care reform is complicated now. Earlier, we spoke to House Democrat Anthony Weiner. He said the 60-vote rule in the Senate is hindering the passage of important legislation.
This 60-vote rule is really what is giving us the logjam that so many people are decrying.
Democrats are signaling they'll scale back the health care bill, though. The president will step up measures on pressure on Wall Street later this morning, announcing a plan to give the government new powers to limit the size of the nation's largest banks, as well as to stop them from trading on their own deposit accounts.
It's official. O'Brien is out. Conan O'Brien to leave The Tonight Show and take $32 million with him. This from The New York Times.
Is he a relative of yours, Miles?
Sadly not.
Sadly not. Asian markets are mixed. European indices now up. Futures have turned up, though, in the last hour. Dow gets underway at 10,603. The S&P opens at 1,138. The NASDAQ opens at 2,291. More with Admiral Mike Mullen in a moment. And we're asking you, what do you think of the Senate 60-vote rule? Should we change it? Is it a good thing? Does it prevent bad legislation? You tell us. 877-8-MY-TAKE.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee.
Good morning, everyone. Good morning, Miles O'Brien.
Good morning.
We begin this morning with more of that wide-ranging conversation I had yesterday at the Pentagon with the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, Admiral Mike Mullen. Haiti was just one part of the discussion. And a moment ago, we heard about how U.S. forces are working with the Haitian government. The Associated Press says the military has begun preparing about 100 tents at Guantanamo Bay for Haitian migrants. I asked Admiral Mullen, how important are facilities like Guantanamo Bay to transitioning the injured from Haiti?
We're aware of the medical support that is available in a place like Guantanamo, and we haven't seen any large requirement for that right now. What's been the struggle initially with this is because those who have been injured so badly, many of them are crush injuries. We've seen infection set in, and many amputations have had to occur. So you just can't show up to a medical facility. If you will, it's not any kind of non-serious injury. We're really trying to focus on those major ones, but there are also significant additional medical requirements that we're trying to meet. It takes supplies, it takes distribution, and we're just not there yet. An awful lot of people working to try to get this right. And I see this as, along with food and water, as the most significant challenge.
Is the Gitmo facility available to you, however, for people to move off island?
It's an option, certainly an option that General Fraser and General Keane and USAID has as a part of this. But there are actually distribution issues. Literally, there are hospitals on Haiti that have rooms. Now, they're not located necessarily right downtown, so we think we need to work to distribute some of those patients who are in hospitals once they've received the care to move them out to some of these other areas.
All right, moving to other responsibilities. The president said, referring to the Christmas Day bombing attempt of the Northwest Airlines jet, that we are at war with Al-Qaeda. Let's be clear. I believe those were the words. Is that your understanding, Admiral?
Yeah, it is very clear. This is a group, and I've said this over a long period of time, and it has been diminished somewhat in the last couple of years, but this is a group that's still trying to kill Americans. They're still trying to kill Westerners. The December 25th incident in Detroit is an example of that. The Headley arrest, the Zazi arrest, the five Americans who were recently picked up in Pakistan, all of that is very much associated with an overall strategic direction to still try to generate catastrophic attacks, killing innocent people, killing innocent Americans, as many as they can. And so in that regard, you bet we're at war with them.
That's Admiral Michael Mullen, chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, in a conversation yesterday at the Pentagon. We went on to discuss the Pakistan-Afghan border in the context of this new surge that President Obama has ordered. And if he saw a situation there, the admiral did, where we might send in either drones or infantry across the Pakistani border.
I don't see any circumstances at this point where we're going to have any ground troops that would cross that border. I mean, that's just not part of it. I don't see it. It hasn't changed as a result of this strategy. The question about Afghanistan and Pakistan, what I have learned over the last two-plus years, having been heavily engaged in this, is it's not one country or another. They're two sovereign countries. Obviously, they border each other, and they're inextricably linked in many, many ways, in particular at that border. And that's where we believe Al-Qaeda leadership resides. That's where the Afghan Taliban have a safe haven, and they use that safe haven to come into Afghanistan to kill Afghan citizens, to kill Afghan security forces, and to kill Americans. And so we're very focused on that and that border. That border is one that I believe is the epicenter of terrorism.
In terms of the rules of engagement with our relationship with Pakistan, help me to understand how a Pakistan military officer might be involved in drone surveillance on Pakistani territory. Would they initiate? Would they provide intelligence? Would they provide suggestions or targets? Or is it completely a U.S.-initiated operation?
Well, I don't talk about these operations in any kind of detail at all. Where we are in terms of what we're doing with the Pakistani military, and we've been doing it for some time, is we have provided training and support for their operations. I was there in December. I went up and spent the entire day in SWAT. And a year ago, there were many who had predicted SWAT would never return to what it was, because the insurgents had basically taken it over. Well, the PAC mill went in there, and they basically have turned it around, gotten rid of the insurgents. They achieved something many people predicted that they couldn't achieve, as an example. So, and we have worked to support them in terms of training, and I've been to the training center where we've done that, and it's really been exquisite training. They've worked hard, they've learned well, and they've had a big impact.
Finally, in the White House Situation Room that I happened to pass through yesterday, I noticed there were a number of digital clocks that sort of monitor places around the world that are obviously of interest. Of course, there was Washington, there was Kabul, there was Port-au-Prince. But I noticed that there was Sana'a, capital of Yemen. Is that an indication that surveillance on the part of the White House and security operations and perhaps the Pentagon, surveillance in Yemen is as important as the relief operation in Port-au-Prince right now or the operation in Kabul, that it has a similar priority?
Well, right now we're very focused on Haiti, and it really is at the top of the list. But we don't do that and ignore the other challenges. And I have been concerned for a significant period of time about the growing potential and now what I see in execution of a new safe haven for al-Qaeda leadership in Yemen. And it's clearly there. And it goes to Fort Hood and the Alaqui, who is the imam, who is actually an American citizen, spent a lot of time here, who is at the center of fostering not just Hassan, but a lot of other activities, as an example, and he resides in Yemen. And there are others. And so we've got an increased level of focus on Yemen. We've increased our support to the Yemen security forces. I don't just mean recently. We've actually done that over the last couple of years. We expect it to grow significantly over the next year and for the same reason, to enable them to get at this very serious threat, not just to us, but also to the people of Yemen and the government of Yemen. It is in certainly our list of top priorities that we're spending a lot of time on.
That was Admiral Michael Mullen, Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, speaking with me at the Pentagon yesterday. You can see some of that interview in video on our new website, thetakeaway.org, and we'll air the rest of our wide-ranging interview tomorrow on The Takeaway. Now at 15 minutes after the hour, let's check in on some of the stories we're following, Miles.
Following close on these, his win on Tuesday, Massachusetts Republican Senator-elect Scott Brown heads to Washington today. He'll meet with the senior senator from Massachusetts, John Kerry. Meanwhile, some are calling Brown's win a referendum on the Obama administration. Last night on ABC, the president responded.
Here's my assessment of not just the vote in Massachusetts, but the mood around the country. The same thing that swept Scott Brown into office swept me into office. People are angry and they're frustrated.
But the president says he won't give up on health care reform. We'll get more on that from our Washington correspondent Todd Zwillick in a few moments.
U.S. Defense Secretary Robert Gates is in Pakistan for unannounced meetings with the country's leaders. He says the Pakistani offensive on the border with Afghanistan is highly important.
You can't ignore one part of this cancer and pretend that it won't have some impact closer to home.
Secretary Gates is also going to discuss the latest U.S. strategy in Afghanistan.
Here at home, former Democratic Senator John Edwards admitting he fathered a child with a woman he had hired before his second White House bid. Edwards had long denied he was the father. Entertainment news now. NBC says it has reached an exit agreement with Tonight Show host Conan O'Brien. The deal would let Jay Leno return to the late-night program he hosted for 17 years. Under Leno, Tonight was a ratings champ in the 11:35 p.m. Eastern slot, but his brief experiment in primetime proved to be a flop.
Conan walks away with more than 40 mil. Coming up, Starbucks hit hard by the recession, but is it a leading indicator leading us out? Louise Story will talk.
Hey, you want that to go?
So our first news takeout this morning is all about that political takedown in Washington, D.C. Todd Zwillick, Washington correspondent, joins us. So congressional Democrats were kind of figuring out what to do next based on the result in Massachusetts. Todd?
Hi, good morning, John. Yep, they absolutely are. This whole idea, John, of having the House and Senate agree on a health care bill and then having the Senate, you know, pass it with 60 votes while it can before Scott Brown gets to Washington seems to be completely off the table now. Listen to Harry Reid from yesterday.
We're not going to rush into anything. We're going to wait until the new senator arrives before we do anything more on health care.
Now, Todd, can you decode that for me? What's deep in the text there?
All right. Well, on the face of it, we're not going to do anything. Democrats have decided it would be politically unsavory to ram something through on health care before Scott Brown gets there when they still have 60 votes. Fine. The subtext, though, is that health care still has to get done. They want to move on to other things. It's been out here long enough. And where's all the pressure now? Harry Reid has thrown all the pressure back onto Nancy Pelosi in the House. That's what he's done with that statement, because it still has to pass. And remember, we sort of mentioned yesterday, I think, that one of the only options they have now is to have the House simply pass the bill that the Senate has already passed. Now, the House hates that bill, and they would have to do a whole bunch of other maneuvers to make it palatable to a lot of the liberals and progressives and even some of the conservatives, frankly, everybody in the Democratic side in the House. So Reid has just thrown it all on Nancy Pelosi there. So story's in the House now.
Well, the pressure for some House members might actually be welcome, since they're sick and tired of being ignored for so long. But Congress is moving on some Haiti legislation. Let's talk about that before we go.
Yeah, a whiff of bipartisanship. Yesterday, the House passed unanimously, John, a bill. Listen just to the details really quickly. Anything you give to Haiti between January 11th, which is when the earthquake was in Haiti, and March 1st, you can write off of your 2009 taxes. So you can take the deduction right away. You just have to show a phone bill showing the contribution and the name of the organization. The Senate, a whiff of bipartisanship, so that make it a little bit easier for people to give to Haiti.
Congress doing something. There we go. Todd Zwillick, Washington correspondent. And thanks so much, Todd.
Let's get the latest from Haiti this morning. Joining us on the line right now from the center of the city of Port-au-Prince is the BBC's Adam Minot. He's the world affairs correspondent there, the BBC, our partner here on The Takeaway. Adam, good to have you with us. Just describe where you are and what you're seeing right now and how things are developing in Haiti.
Well, what we're seeing is a gradual ramp up of the aid operation here. It's been a slow process, and some people here are very unhappy at the speed at which food has been getting out. But that is starting. I was in a number of these rough encampments that have been set up all over the town earlier. These have been set up largely by homeless people, or indeed by people who still have houses but feel too frightened to sleep inside them. So there are tens of thousands of people out on the street, and really the bulk of them have not received any international food aid, which is absolutely vital. They are getting some water, which is good. That is arriving, but food is what they really need.
Why is the aid not getting there?
Well, it's a difficult process, and there are probably a number of reasons. I think the main one is that the relief operation is really having to start from scratch. There was absolutely no capacity whatsoever in the country to assist any food dispersal. That said, I think a lot of people agree that it could have happened, even in a fairly rudimentary fashion, a lot more quickly. And I think probably too much time has been spent setting up processes, securing sites, deciding programs, and actually they should have simply dumped some food on the streets and allowed the people who are here who need it desperately to get their hands on it, because what is turning not nasty, but I think some people are turning slightly angry now that this promised food that they've had now for, what is it, nine days simply hasn't appeared.
Well, you know, you could understand the reluctance to just drop food in and the possible ramifications of that. In retrospect, I gather you think that's a mistake. Is this a function of the lack of leadership in the Haitian government, or is there something else going on?
I think, as I said, I think there are probably a multiplicity of factors, and you're right, you don't just dump food and allow people to get on with it, but I do think that probably there is a balance to be found between dumping food and letting people grab it, and at the other end having a very precisely organised system for dispersal, because the needs are so desperate. People, they are getting scraps of food, and people are sharing food, they're buying food at vastly inflated prices, but what we normally see in these circumstances where things like pulses, rice, grain, sorghum, together with some cooking oil, maybe some salt and sugar being passed out. This simply hasn't begun on a large scale. What's been going out have largely been packets of high-energy biscuits. And I think that really the international relief effort should have concentrated on getting some of that out in whatever form very early on, rather than trying to build up an elaborate process for getting a really tight dispersal and distribution system underway.
Give us a sense a little bit about the medical care situation there, Adam. I know you spent yesterday at a hospital. We've talked to some doctors this morning. What they're telling us is they may have turned a corner on that. Are they being a little too sanguine?
No, I think that's a fair justification. I mean, it's a big corner to turn, and the hospital I went to, they're amputating about 50 limbs a day. So that gives you a sense of the appalling injuries that people have suffered. The health relief that's coming in, the medical teams are doing an extraordinary job in extraordinary conditions. So that is working, but my goodness, they've got a task ahead of them.
The rooster crowing on a new morning there in Haiti.
In Haiti, with all you're describing there, Adam, I'd be worried if I was that chicken.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. What is it? How would you? These questions I sometimes don't like, but how would you characterize the mood of the people this morning? I know there's a lot of panic 24 hours ago because of the aftershock. How are people coping right now?
Well, they are remarkably resilient, the people here. They're used to tragedy. They're used to disasters, natural and man-made. They're capable as a people of picking themselves up and bouncing back, but they've got quite a mountain to climb here.
Adam Minot, World Affairs Correspondent with our partner, the BBC. Thank you for your time.
Adam is great. Coming up, who are those independent voters that sent that shock round the world from Massachusetts? We'll talk about that in just a few minutes.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee.
Coming up, was Tuesday really Independence Day? Of course, I mean independent voters. We'll talk in a few moments about independence and Tuesday's defeat for Democrats. Here are some other stories we're following for you 30 minutes past the hour. President Obama is sending more U.S. troops to Haiti. Right now, some 11,000 soldiers are in and around the country. Another 2,000 Marines heading to the earthquake zone soon. The president telling ABC News U.S. relief efforts help America's image.
I want to make sure that when America projects its power around the world, it's not seen only when it's fighting a war.
Part of that projection includes the USNS Comfort, which is now docked off the coast of Port-au-Prince and is treating some of the worst-off patients. Tim Donahue is a surgeon on board.
I've got five operating rooms running right now on patients that are getting, you know, washouts, amputations, and revisions of their amputations. So it's picking up at a good clip.
In another move to help Haiti recover, there are reports of banks reopening this weekend, which would help the flow of money from Haitians overseas.
Markets are reacting this morning to the news just out that weekly claims for unemployment rose 36,000 to 482,000. That was about what was expected, but futures are down on Wall Street. Goldman Sachs is expected to announce its 2009 bonuses today. Its earnings topped $9 billion. It's expected that Goldman Sachs will set aside between $16 and $19 billion in compensation for last year, which averages out to about $600,000 per employee. Yesterday at the Pentagon, I asked Joint Chiefs of Staff Chairman Admiral Mike Mullen about an Associated Press story that the U.S. has begun preparing tents at Guantanamo Bay in case there's a mass migration of Haitians fleeing the island.
Is the Gitmo facility available to you, however, for people to move off island?
It's an option, certainly an option that General Fraser and General Keane and USAID has as a part of this.
Portions of that interview you can see on our website, thetakeaway.org. And here is from the Annals of Stupidity, our final story. What's your online password? According to our partner, the New York Times, the most popular password is 123456. Miles?
That's brilliant.
Second
That's brilliant.
Most popular
yeah.
password? 12345.
12345. 12345.
Yes.
That's amazing. I've got the same combination on my luggage.
Password itself even made the top 20. Internet security analysts say, don't make it so easy for hackers. The Dow gets underway at 10,603. Futures have turned south. Those are some of the stories we're following this morning.
hope they're paying close attention, because tonight the independent voice of Massachusetts has spoken.
It's newly elected Massachusetts, well, Senator-elect Scott Brown in his acceptance speech on Tuesday. You know, they don't call him independent for nothing. Are independents getting more conservative, or are they just a contrary group? Either way, they are how elections are decided in this country. A year ago, they sent Obama and a commanding Democratic majority to Washington. In Massachusetts, they seem to repudiate that decision. Let's get into this. Ross Baker is a political science professor at Rutgers University, and Jay Campbell is vice president of Hart Research, a polling firm. Let's begin with you, Ross. Independents. They're hard to figure, aren't they? And they're hard for political pros to corral, aren't they?
Political scientists hate them. Political scientists love Democrats and Republicans because they're more predictable. Independents, you're untethered. They kind of go with the wind. There was a time when, in fact, independents were kind of treated contemptuously because they were considered to be less educated and less affluent than voters with strong party attachments. And now that's not the case. Independent voters tend to be somewhat more affluent, better educated, but still highly volatile, unpredictable, mercurial.
So the smarter people are leaving the parties. Jay Campbell, tell us a little bit about the numbers. Are independents becoming more conservative, or are they just generally contrary to whomever is in power?
Well, first I'd say that in contrast to political scientists, pollsters love independents because they're sort of a fascinating group to watch and to follow. And I think, Miles, the answer is both. For one thing, as Ross said, by their very nature, they're independent. They are contrary. They don't fall into the neat categories that so often Republicans and Democrats can and do. At the same time, we've seen evidence that, in fact, independents are becoming more conservative over time. In a poll we conducted for the Wall Street Journal and NBC News in December, we asked independents straight up, have you found yourself over the past couple of years becoming more conservative, or do you not feel that way? And almost half, 48% of independents say yes, in fact, they have been becoming more conservative.
And this is over what time frame, though?
This is over the past couple of years. It was a vague time frame, but if you sort of work backwards, past couple of years, it does include the 2006 elections, where we found that the number of Republicans at that time sort of started to drop a little bit, the number of people who identified themselves as Republican.
So,
the theory being that a lot of former Republicans are now calling themselves independents, and thus becoming a bit more conservative. At the same time, as you pointed out, they voted for change in Washington in 2008, and I would argue in 2006 as well. And part of the reason that the Democratic Party is having so much trouble now with this group is because we found that they don't necessarily think that Barack Obama has sort of sealed the deal with the change in Washington that they were expecting and that they voted for.
So, Ross, the two-party system, is it being completely undermined here? Is this the end of the two-party system we're seeing unfold?
Well, I think for a time, in some states, you've had the electorate divided pretty much into thirds. A third Democratic, a third Republican, a third Independent. Democrats, of course, were said to be to outnumber Republicans in Massachusetts, but Democrats in Massachusetts are only 37%. Massachusetts, even as blue a state,
even the People's Republic of Massachusetts, 37%.
Yes, that's right. That's right.
Democratic.
And I have another feeling, Miles, about what happened on Tuesday. And that may well be a revolt of the haves. I think that these were affluent people. There are also people, of course, living in Massachusetts already have health insurance. So the idea of piling national health insurance on top of state health insurance may have seemed to many of them to be redundant.
That's sort of close to the bone in Massachusetts itself. But Ross and Jay, I mean, it doesn't make me feel good that pollsters like independents, because I'm wondering, and maybe just taking the contrary view myself here, Ross, if this inchoate anger going back and forth, first in, then out, is a mechanism for making pretty bad policy of never getting anything done, Ross?
Well, I think that that's certainly a danger. When you have voters who really have no enduring set of views about what the appropriate role of government is, for example, sometimes thinking perhaps it ought to be more interventionist, other times less interventionist, I think it just complicates things, and I think it makes trying to figure out what the voters are thinking a lot more difficult. I mean, I agree with Jay that certainly we've seen a trend toward these so-called independents becoming more conservative. And there's a school of thought that says there really are no true independents. There are leaners. There are independents who lean Democratic and independents who lean Republican. And I think if Jay's numbers are right, I think probably the leaning toward the Republicans seems to be the most recent trend.
All right, Jay, very quickly, give us a sense, factor this into the midterm election.
Well, the midterm election is going to be interesting, to say the least. And I think it's definitely true, to John's point a moment ago, that it makes things difficult to get done in Washington. But I would say that really, independents would agree with that. And that's why they're independent. They see partisanship as the real problem here.
Jay Campbell, Ross Baker, thanks for the political talk this morning. Appreciate it. Coming up in the hour, we're going to have a tech talk. It is Thursday. And the tech world is all abuzz with Apple's rumored IT product, iSlate, iPad, who knows what they call it.
The iIt.
It's time for an iBreak. This is The Takeaway. I'm Miles O'Brien in for Celeste Headlee this week.
And I'm John Huckenberry. Back to Haiti now. The UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon this weekend asked his former Haitian spokeswoman to come out of retirement and help the UN rebuild Haiti as part of the post-earthquake relief effort. That spokesperson, journalist Michelle Montaz, joins us now from Port-au-Prince, former Haitian journalist. And Michelle, tell me, first of all, what's the headline for the UN in Port-au-Prince this morning?
Well, you know, for the UN, it is mostly right now the effort of getting food and medicine to people, of evacuating the people who have been wounded. A lot of them are being evacuated to the Dominican Republic. The UN has created, with the help of the Dominicans, has created a protected corridor to go from Port-au-Prince to Jimani and to Santo Domingo to give people assistance. At the same time, there is a huge effort to get food to people. It is still disorganized. It is still chaotic. You have to realize that MINUSTAH has still 300 people missing. The whole infrastructure of MINUSTAH has collapsed, but with the people that have come in, we are trying to get going again in terms of helping people. This is the most immediate thing. We have lost almost all hopes to get more people alive. However, you know, there were a number, a small number that got out of the rubble yesterday. They were taken to hospitals. So it is a joint effort, not only of the UN, but other groups that are here, the U.S. forces, the Canadians, the Japanese. There are field hospitals being set in different places. A field hospital from the Japanese is set in Leogan. So there is that effort to try to take care of the many wounded. There are a lot of amputations being done because a lot of limbs have been lost. And we are still losing people because we don't have enough doctors everywhere to really assist the people who have been taken out of the rubble.
Michelle Montaz, explain how the UN is rebuilding, because, of course, they were one of the key victims in the earthquake itself.
Well, we have, John and Miles, we have some people that have come in temporarily, that have been flown in from New York, from different areas, from different UN headquarters or UN missions, people who were in Haiti before. They are brought in, and some of them, you know, used to be in political affairs. They are distributing foods. Some people, I mean, we are all trying to get first the immediate task taken care of. So that is what is at hand right now. The UN has brought in some administrative people. As you know, we have lost all the archives of the UN, of the minister. We cannot trace a number of things, but at least we are trying to set up a skeleton that can coordinate the help that is coming in from all over.
Well, explaining the effort he was dispatched to do, Michelle Montaz, joining us from Port-au-Prince, brought out of retirement by UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon this weekend. The former Haitian journalist and the former spokesperson for Ban Ki-moon is a part of the relief effort down in Port-au-Prince. We spoke to Michelle Montaz live from Port-au-Prince.
Good morning. I'm Miles O'Brien in for Celeste Headlee on vacation with John Hockenberry.
Celeste is on vacation with John Hockenberry?
Apparently so.
Oh, really?
No, I think you're here.
I'm here. Okay, yeah, good.
Every day's a vacation for you because you're having fun, right? Yeah.
Right.
Coming up with the program.
Coming up. Settle down. Try to control yourself.
Why don't we check the headlines, shall we? Let's do that. Let's get down to some business here. 47 minutes past the hour. Passage of the health care bill may be in jeopardy. That's after the Republican Scott Brown took a key Senate seat in Massachusetts on Tuesday. But last night on ABC, the president said he won't give up on the reform effort. In Haiti, as the relief effort continues, U.S. officials on the ground are paying tribute to the resilience of the Haitian people. Here's U.S. Navy Lieutenant Commander Andrew Grabas.
The resolve of the Haitian people are absolutely phenomenal. They are more than accommodating. They move back when necessary. They help us out when necessary. It's amazing to see the human nature at its finest right now.
Meanwhile, back home, the House passed a bill allowing taxpayers who make donations to earthquake victims to write off their donations when filing their 2009 taxes. That measure is expected to pass the Senate today. Just out, new jobless claims rose more than expected to 482,000 last week. That news just out, and it's affecting markets. Futures are declining at this point. Overseas, China's economy grew by a massive 8.7% last year, putting it in place to overtake Japan and becomes the world's second largest economy. I guess next it would be the U.S. that they would overtake, right? That's the largest economy.
They're nipping at our heels.
Those are some of the stories we're following this morning.
All right, put your quill down, John. It's tech time.
Quill.
The Luddite over here. It's Thursday. The takeaway means talk tech. We talk tech. And listen carefully. Shh. I hear the sound of some heavy hype.
Everyone's been talking about this ice lake.
What we all believe we're going to see it this January 27th.
An iPod on steroids.
A 7-inch Apple tablet.
$1,000 consumer item.
A Kindle killer. An iPod killer.
So 3 or 4 times the price of the Kindle.
It's all speculation at this point.
We're still talking about a mythical creature here.
What are they talking about?
Well, with buzz like that, it must be something sleek and caressable from Cupertino, California. Apple's new tablet, iPad, iSlate, I give up. Stephen Levy has some opinions on the matter. He's been following Apple for years, as his Wired readers know. He's also the author of The Perfect Thing, How iPod Shuffles Commerce, Culture, and Coolness. And Cliff Kwong is here in the studio with us. He also writes for Wired and blogs about design and tech for Fast Company, has some opinions of his own. Cliff, first of all, a lot of buzz about the name of this device, this amazing thing, whatever it is. iPad, what do you think it's going to be?
All the things that I've been reading indicated it's going to be iSlate. There were some, sort of shell company shenanigans that happened to register that name, apparently under Apple's rubrics. So it looks like it's going to be the iSlate, although, we'll see.
Classic Steve Jobs, right, Stephen, to be going around and grabbing names and filing lawsuits, all that kind of thing?
Right. Well, the criminology around Apple is, makes Russia look pretty shabby, really. Every patent Apple files, every trademark foray is examined pretty closely. And if every one of these things that people examined came about, Apple would have 10,000 products with a million names. So it's going to winnow down to one product and one name. And there's always something about that product, though sometimes people guess the name, which no one anticipates. So,
but is this going to result in slate casts and slate books? And, is the language going to change again here?
Podcasts.
Well, yeah, that is what happens here. That's why half the words in the English language these days begin with a small I and a capital letter after it.
I'm going to change my name to I Miles. All right, Cliff, let me ask you this. Let's talk about what this product is.
Sure.
This is kind of an overgrown iPhone. Is that it?
I think that to be clear, we should ask what does this thing do? I don't think the world needs another sort of slim computer that's about 10 inches.
Hello.
Right?
Yeah,
we've done that.
So the interesting thing, though, is that this is being touted as something that could potentially have a sort of rich media reading experience that, for example, the Kindle doesn't offer, the Kindle being like a sort of black and white book reader. And the reason that you even want something richer than that is that you could potentially then start migrating content like magazines and newspapers and even books too, into something like the iSlate in a way that hasn't ever really been done before, ever been done very well.
So more function than the Kindle, more money. Stephen, they got to be nervous about this at Amazon.
Well, of course they are. They're not, Amazon. Strength really is what's on the other side of the Kindle is all those books and an easy way to get to them.
It's all about the content.
But Cliff makes a really important point here. So theoretically, based on what you're reading, and Stephen, what do you think? I mean, people could take Photoshop layouts and port them directly to this, and you're really creating whole new ideas of magazines. Digital magazines suddenly become a completely rich media concept with video.
And I think what's really been interesting is that essentially publishing companies, Condé Nast, which I was Wired included, have been salivating at this idea. Basically, they've been begging the industry to create something
of interest.
They're already developing content for a device that they don't know exists yet. It's sort of amazing.
Well, Stephen, give us a little bit of the backstory here. There's a lot of tension between the publishers and Amazon because they got a monopoly and they've been offering up very low prices for these books, right?
Definitely. And then there's another player in there called Google.
I've heard of them.
Which is part of this complication. The story in tech used to be Apple versus Microsoft, and now we've got a triangle or a four-way thing going between Microsoft and Apple and Google and Amazon in some of these skirmishes, and in each. Each company has sort of a big edge and dominance in one certain area and wants to leverage that to dominate in everything.
The power of four here. What do you think, Cliff?
Well, I think that the important thing to remember in this story is, when you look at something like iSlate and you ask why it's generated so much hype, I mean, I think the answer is that so many industries are looking to this as their savior, right?
Right.
I mean, you've got magazines, which 2 years ago people were saying were safe, but now are actually in quite serious trouble. And this something like this could really help sell the new idea of magazines. And Apple is good at that in a way that no publisher actually is.
I think we've got two magazine writers here fighting for their jobs.
I think it could be. I'm detecting a little desperation in the room.
Well, I will say that it's not guaranteed that it'll work, right? I mean, there have been efforts like this in the past, like to introduce magazines to CD-ROMs and things like that that haven't worked.
All right. Well, next time we'll talk about it. We'll figure out what it's all about and
it'll
know
here.
What it is.
It'll be the iSlate. Cliff says it's the iSlate.
Cliff Kwong, Stephen Levy, thank you very much for your time.
So if you want to re-listen to anything on today's show or actually re-podcast that interview with Cliff and Stephen, we're always on at The Takeaway. You can take our podcast to go. Subscribe now at iTunes or at our website, thetakeaway.org. So should The Takeaway be a rich media experience on this new iSlate? Miles, we could have like a 3D U.
A hologram.
We could have Celeste.
An hologram.
A spaceship or something.
Yeah. Wow.
Great.
That's why
we don't work for Apple. That's clear. One thing you're going to definitely want to check out is our interview with the Joint Chiefs of Staff, Mike Mullen, Admiral Mike Mullen. While you're at iSlate, you can watch a video and find out why he Twitters. It's true. He Twitters. He's a big Twitterer.
He's on Flicker. He's on Facebook. Yeah. He's Twitter.
And it's all because of Mrs. Mullen. You'll find out that at thetakeaway.org. And we're talking with all of you about the Democrats' loss in Massachusetts. We've been hearing for months that you have to have that 60 votes in the Senate to get any kind of reform passed, including health care reform. So does not reaching that number prevent Congress from making big, scary changes?
Coakley's loss is actually good news for congressional Democrats because it gives them an excuse to sell us out even more to the insurance industry by watering down the so-called reform even further. We only have 59 seats in the Senate now, they say. But let's remember, 59 seats is more than Bush ever had back when he was getting anything he wanted.
This is Paul from Nutley, New Jersey. There really isn't a 60-vote rule. It's a majority rule. If somebody wants to filibuster a good idea, let them, and let them look like idiots for doing so.
Troy from North Dakota. As an independent, I feel that questioning the Senate's 60-vote rule is purely a liberal Democrat thought right now. But I have to say I am surprised that the GOP wasn't questioning it when they were on the losing end of it.
Pete emails us with this. I don't understand why no one ever actually filibusters. Apparently they register their intent to do so, and that's good enough. Harry Reid should bring the bill to the floor and make them go all Jimmy Stewart on it. When nothing gets done, the Democrats, if they have any sense, could point to the filibuster du jour and blame him, her, for the impasse.
What's that movie he's referring to there, Pete?
Mr.
Jimmy
Smith.
Mr. Smith goes to Washington. That's right. Nikki writes on our website, thetakeaway.org. She says, I agree it's time to eliminate the filibuster. Perhaps could be retained for amendments to the Constitution, but otherwise, time to go. You know how to reach us? 877-8-MY-TAKE or go to our website, thetakeaway.org.
I'm Miles O'Brien.
I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
Thanks for listening to The Takeaway podcast. If there's a story you think we should look at or a conversation you'd like us to start, drop us a line at 877-8-MY-TAKE or email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, the New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for the New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.